It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today's talk on the sixth and the hardest to talk about, paramita, the perfection of wisdom, it's both exalted and totally not understandable. But let me give you some of the wonderful things that various wise teachers have said. Starting with Reb Tenchin Roshi, he says, the teaching and practice of perfect wisdom is intended for bodhisattvas. Although one may wonder upon hearing this, if one is a bodhisattva, I, Reb, feel that all living beings are bodhisattvas. Whether we know it or not, we are all on the same path to perfect enlightenment for the welfare of this world. At this moment, all Buddhas are setting an example for bodhisattvas sitting upright in stillness in the middle of the fierce flames of suffering, sitting at the center of all suffering beings, turning the wheel of Dharma, gently transmitting the great perfection of wisdom. And he continues, many people in the West do not associate Zen with devotional practice, yet the path of perfect wisdom and Buddhahood is nothing if not devotional. The path to Buddhahood is the path of complete devotion to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the awakening to the teachings of awakening and to the awakening community. Zen practice is devoted to the realization of perfect wisdom for the welfare of all beings and the great earth. Zen practitioners aspire to embody and express perfect wisdom in all the activities of daily life. So in his great awakening, Shakyamuni Buddha realized the dependent co-arising of samsara, that means birth and death, and the dependent co-arising of nirvana, which means the cessation of birth and death, and the dependent co-arising of everything, including his own realization. The dependent co-arising of nirvana is non-conceptual perfect wisdom. That's the perfection of wisdom. It's not conceptual. It's not available to our conceptual understanding. And by the way, when I say dependent co-arising, when I use that word or term, think interconnectedness, because somehow interconnectedness isn't so mental. It's an easier thing to imagine. So some say that the articulation of dependent co-arising is the central philosophy of what is called the first turning of the Dharma wheel. We've talked about this before, and I'm going to go over it right now, that there were three turnings of the Dharma wheel. And the first was about conceptual truth. So The first turning of the Dharma wheel, which offers a conceptual approach to liberation from birth and death. And that's going to be the subject of their next series. The conceptual version of liberation from birth and death, which are the 12 links of dependent arising. But don't worry about that now. I think you'll enjoy it very much. It's really easy to understand and it's very logical. So that's the first turning of the wheel. And the second one offers the perfect wisdom scriptures, which are a non-conceptual approach to liberation based on the emptiness of all phenomena. The two perfect wisdom scriptures most studied are celebrated in Zen as the Heart Sutra and the Jaiman Sutra. And later on, there was a third turning of the wheel. And these teachings were offered to protect us from the nihilistic understanding of the teachings of the second turning. So if we go around thinking, well, nothing exists anyway, so why bother with anything? The third turning protects us from that. The third turning was something like, we understand that there's ultimate truth. We understand that ultimate truth, which is like emptiness, is the truth, but we have to live. And so we have conventional truth to live by. But in our minds, we know that there's that ultimate truth, that conventional truth is not really the final word. So the third turning is we live by conventional truths, knowing that ultimate truths exist and that that's what's really, really the truth. So we don't get as attached to our conventional truths. That's the whole point. So the first turning is conventional truth. The second turning is ultimate truth. And the third turning is conventional truth, remembering that there's ultimate truth. I hope that's clear. It's not that hard to understand. It just sounds hard. So the two sutras that convey the ultimate truth are the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra. And I want to give you a little taste of both of them. The Diamond Sutra of Perfect Wisdom, which is taught and celebrated in our liturgy, and plays a big part in the life of the sixth ancestor, Huineng, whose family name was Lu, and he was known as Layman Lu. After his father died, Layman Lu supported himself and his mother by selling firewood. And one day a customer purchased some firewood and asked him to deliver it. And when he delivered it, outside of the shop, he heard a traveler reciting a scripture encouraging bodhisattvas to live a mind that has no abode. To live a mind that has no abode. Hearing the words of the sutra, Layman Lu's mind opened into awakening. So Layman Lu basically attained enlightenment just hearing the words of this scripture. And he asked the traveler what scripture this was. And the traveler told him that it was the Diamond Sutra of Perfect Wisdom. And the traveler also told him that the Diamond Sutra was one of the main teachings of the fifth ancestor, Hongren, and that he, the traveler, had obtained the scripture from the fifth ancestor at his monastery. So hearing this, Layman Lu felt profound aspiration to travel the long distance from southern China to northern China and receive the transmission of the teachings face to face. Fortunately, one of his customers gave Layman Lu 10 ounces of silver to enable him to support his mother in his absence. So off he went on Reb, as on Reb puts it, one of the most greatest adventures in the history of perfect wisdom. He met his teacher, he received the robe and transmission of Dharma from him, and he became the sixth ancestor, now called Huineng. And from him, the lotus flower of perfect wisdom bloomed into five schools of Zen. So the lineage of all five schools of Zen leads back to Huineng, the sixth Chinese ancestor. At the beginning of the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha's disciple, the Venerable Subhuti, S-U-B-H-U-T-I, Subhuti. And Subhuti asks the Buddha how a good son or daughter should set forth on the Bodhisattva path and how they should stand, walk, and care for their thoughts. And among everything that the Buddha told him, here are four pieces of advice that the Buddha gave to Subhuti. First, that bodhisattvas should vow to embrace and sustain all beings so that those beings will mature and allow themselves to be carried to nirvana. So embrace and sustain all beings. Second, that bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, is our true nature, but training and time are required to realize it. So that's a truth that the Buddha passed on to Subhuti. Bodhicitta is our true nature, but training and time are required to realize it. And third, we need to remember our vow to attain perfect enlightenment for the welfare of this world, but that we will not abide in that vow by thinking it is something that belongs to us. We take the vow and we cherish it, but we never think that it belongs to us. And fourth, and this is the first big surprise in this story, Buddha says that although limitless beings have been led to nirvana, not a single being has been led to nirvana. And why not? If in a bodhisattva the idea of a living being should take place, then he or she is not properly called a bodhisattva. And why? Because a bodhisattva does not take ideas of self, our being, our person, to be ultimate truth, and does not adhere to them as such. So we've talked about this before. Ultimately speaking, the self has no inherent existence. And don't forget, there's a difference between existing and having inherent existence. So we exist as an interconnected whole with all other beings, but we don't exist from our own side as we think we do. So if we have no inherent existence, we really can't speak of accomplishments of this non-existing self. On the other hand, conventionally speaking, we live with the idea of having a self that needs definite guidelines for proper behavior. So this is why nothing is always so in Buddhism. It's really hard to talk about. As soon as you say one thing, then something else is true. So in the Diamond Sutra, vow comes first, followed by the surprising practice of perfect wisdom, which is it doesn't belong to us, and It's, you know, and it's not true anyway. Because realization of the emptiness of the vow is what protects the bodhisattva vow. When we know we can't grasp the vow, we'll let go of it. So we take the vow, giving our whole heart into this vow, and then we give away the merit of taking the vow. And then we do this with all the endeavors of our life. The teaching is here, that there is a reason that things come to be. A thing comes to be itself by the pivotal support of everything that is not itself. Things do not come to be of or by themselves, but through the support of everything other than themselves. All phenomena are nothing more or less than the support of everything other than that phenomena. Therefore, the very reason a thing is itself is precisely the reason that it's not itself. So here we have the logic of mind that has no abode, the words in the sutra that opened Layman Lu's mind into awakening. This is the logic of non-abiding mind. I'm going to say something just that's on my mind, because yesterday I attended a one-day sesshin at Reb's monastery called No Abode. And he asked the assembly for permission to commence a study on a sutra, a great sutra called the Avatamsaka Sutra. And he's already commenced that study with two other assemblies. One, his Dharma heirs. I think he has about 15 Dharma heirs. And then another with all of the students who have served as Shuso at one of the practice places. And that's the ceremony that is prior to becoming a priest. So that's the set. So now he's commencing this study with the assembly who practices at No Abode. And this is a very great sutra. And these other extremely experienced students can't understand a word it says. And most people who study it can't understand a word it says. There's a lot of repetition, but everything is in these gathas, which are these four line, like little poems almost, and you can memorize them. And then you can try to live your life by those four lines. And Reb shared the first one with us, and it starts with the word thus. Thus. And he stopped there because thus is such an incredibly important word in Zen texts. Almost all of the important ones start with the word thus. And almost everything in the end boils down to thusness or suchness or the way. So thus, we almost don't need to go any further. You know, you can just stop your study of the sutra right here. And if you just take the practice of understanding, I know this is me now, you can just take the practice of understanding thus, that's your practice. And that's as far as you get in the Avatamsaka Sutra. I'm just kidding, but it's almost, you get the point. And it's related to what I just said, that we're talking about the mind of no abode. So as soon as you understand something, it disappears into emptiness. And you can get into the spirit of that and start enjoying it, actually. And I think we did a little of that yesterday. So now we come to the Heart Sutra, the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. Is even more shocking than a Diamond Sutra because it rejects all intellectual teachings of the first turning, including the teachings of dependent co-arising. So forget that. That's, you know, just forget that. And then in this sutra, the Bodhisattva of Infinite Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, deigns to speak to us and says, first, when we practice with conventional truth through the six practices of the paramitas, which is what we're doing right now, we open into ultimate truth. When we open to ultimate truth without first being grounded in generosity, ethics, patience, joyful effort, and concentration, it is not real wisdom and can lead people astray. So we're already on the right track. So right now we're grounding ourselves in these five important minds. So you should be sure to do your homework. And then second, Avalokiteshvara is practicing perfect wisdom and realizes that the aggregates of form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness lack a basis for grasping. She sees there's nothing to hold on to. So the aggregates are what it is said that we are composed of, we human beings. There's a physical one and four mental ones. Form is the physical one. Then feelings, perceptions, mental formations, which just mean like they could be dreams, thoughts, and consciousness, they lack a basis. So they lack a basis for grasping. So this is why the Heart Sutra makes a shocking statement regarding the Four Noble Truths. It says that given emptiness, there's neither suffering nor the end of suffering. There's neither arising of suffering nor no suffering. There's neither the cessation of suffering nor no suffering. There are no cessation of suffering. And there's neither a path to the cessation or no path to such cessation. So basically the Four Noble Truths, there's no basis for the Four Noble Truths. This is the first thing that the Heart Sutra is saying, that the third thing the Heart Sutra is saying. And then the fourth thing is perfect wisdom is an organ of vision that sees that there is no basis for apprehending any of the 12 links of dependent arising, which is what the entire series next time is going to be. Our next series is going to be on the 12 links of dependent co-arising. The Heart Sutra says that in emptiness, there is no ignorance and no extinction of it, and so on until we reach no old age and death, and also no extinction of it. This is the vision that the true cessation of samsara and the realization of actual, this is the vision that is the true cessation of samsara and the realization of actual nirvana. So everything already, we already know everything that we're going to talk about in the next series, which begins with ignorance and ends with old age and death, that none of that has any basis in reality. So that's a good way to begin. So the Four Noble Truths, there's no basis in reality for that. And the 12 Links of Dependent Arising, there's no basis for reality in that. There's no basis for reality in the aggregates, which is what we're made of. And as a basis for studying this, we're grounded at least in the paramitas, because they disappear, generosity and ethical behavior and patience and joyful effort and concentration. They, as we practice them, they disappear. So the fifth thing, seeing that samsara offers no basis for grasping, and its cessation, nirvana, also offer no basis for grasping. Okay, this is what we're getting at. Since samsara offers no basis for grasping, and its cessation, nirvana, offers no basis for grasping, this leads to the startling revelation of perfect wisdom. There is no basis for grasping the idea or perception that samsara and nirvana are different. Without any grasping, samsara and nirvana are identical. So that's basically saying conventional truth and ultimate truth are exactly the same thing. They're exactly the same thing. So because there's no basis for grasping either one of them. So there's no basis for distinguishing between ultimate truths and conventional truths. Kodo Sawaki Roshi says that all of the above is perfectly lived and expressed in the posture of zazen. So that's very important. Everything we've just said is grounded in the posture of zazen. It's perfectly lived and expressed in the posture of zazen. So this is how we can ground these difficult to swallow concepts. He says, as indicated by the expression, zazen, is not something to understand, nor is it something not to understand. Zazen is beyond the realm of knowing zazen or not knowing it, or knowing it just a little, nor is it a condition where zazen deepens. Zazen is zazen, and that's all there is to it. This is Kodo Sawaki Roshi. In the beginning, some of us cannot fully understand that zazen is zazen. It is necessary to depend on various forms. But in actual fact, zazen is zazen. There isn't the slightest gap where the ego self can slip in. Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, his book on zazen, and arguably the single most cherished text in the Soto Zen sect, was written on his return from China in 1227. And in it are the following two lines. The Dharma vehicle is free and unrestricted. What need is there for concentrated effort? And one of our Roshis, Seiko Harada Roshi, offers this commentary. The Dharma vehicle is the means for giving life to and using the way. How is it used? You can think of it like a boat in which all things are carried to the other shore. What need is there for concentrated effort? This is to forget yourself, the me, by earnestly being one with each thing. That in itself is all that is required. Earnestly being one in each thing. That's all that's required. And this, this from the Heart Sutra delivered by Kodo Sawaki, August 15th, 1942. And this is a short but amazing talk. Zazen is living the Dharma without confusion. You don't do things in a half-assed way. It is beyond thinking and non-thinking. When you settle into your position, you just hold it. That is your duty. The eye is the eye, working as the eye, and the navel is the navel. They do what they are there to do. There is no difference in the ways of the ancients and the ways of today. Each person practicing Zazen, truly forgetting his self and settling into his position, working at eliminating delusion, will surely succeed. Beyond thinking and non-thinking means nothing extra, one with God, seamless with Buddha, just establishing yourself correctly in your position and practicing there. Sages have nothing, that is no self, no place they call their own. They are one with heaven and earth, one with all things. Each of us should be positioned in no self. The duty that is fully achieved in that position is where no self exists. This is being one with all things. It is the true teaching, the foundation of heaven and earth. Regarding the words, each person practicing Zazen, truly forgetting his self and settling into his position, working at eliminating delusion, will surely succeed. Regarding those words, it is said that Shakyamuni Buddha gave the following example to indicate how certain this is. If you hold the stick in your hand and aim for the ground below, no matter which way you strike the ground, it is impossible to miss it. In the same way, it is impossible not to come to an understanding of the true self if you seek the Dharma and Zen. And this is Seike Harada, I sometimes speak of Zazen as the body, speech, and thought. Sometimes speak of Zazen of the body, speech, and thought. The Zazen of body, Zazen of speech, and Zazen of thought. Zazen of the body is the form of Zazen we are presently sitting in. So they're probably in Sesshin. It is the condition of Zazen Samadhi. Samadhi means complete absorption in the activity itself, so that both oneself and the activity are forgotten. So the Zazen of the body is the form of Zazen, which the condition of Zazen Samadhi, complete absorption. Practice samadhi to the extent that there isn't the least margin for thought to enter. Zazen of speech is the sutra chanting we did this morning when we chant the Heart Sutra and the four Bodhisattva vows. And Zazen of thought includes miscellaneous ideas and various other thoughts, such as making plans. So Zazen of body, speech, and thought all take place separately from the consciousness of the ego self. I think that's really important to understand that there's a Zazen of thought, that there is thought there, but it's separate from the ego self. The Dharma vehicle functions actively in this way. So Seike Harada is just explaining to us how Zazen functions. because we're saying that everything that I said above is grounded in that posture. And now we're told that Zazen works in three. There's a Zazen of the body, Zazen of speech, and Zazen of thought. And they all function separately from the consciousness of ego self. So notice that in the Zazen of body, there is not the least margin for thought to enter. Whereas in the Zazen of thought, thoughts like clouds come and go aimlessly. And this is the intelligence of the Dharma vehicle. So finally, here is a sample of Subhuti and the Buddha speaking of perfect wisdom. And of the Buddha's 10 greatest disciples, Subhuti was foremost in wisdom. So now, this is the last thing I'm going to say. Subhuti is talking now to Shakyamuni Buddha. Once, as the Buddha was teaching at the Prajnaparamita assembly, the Buddha turned to Subhuti and said, "Subhuti, you possess great eloquence. You are able to deeply understand the teachings on true emptiness. You are able to expound the perfection of wisdom teachings before assemblies of bodhisattvas and perfect their understanding. This is truly wonderful." As the Buddha spoke, everyone present in the assembly began to speculate at his meaning and eloquence. Does Subhuti draw from his own wisdom when he expounds such sublime teachings? Or does he rely on the strength of the Buddha's majestic powers when he teaches the Dharma? Knowing the thoughts of the assembly, Subhuti replied, "We cannot go against the Buddha's compassionate wishes. When we disciples teach, no matter how elementary or profound the topic, so long as we are able to adapt to the listener's ability and accord with the Dharma, we must rely on the Buddha's majestic powers. When we utilize the Buddha's majestic powers to teach, we encourage others to practice so that they may realize the true nature of Dharma. One can then accord with the true nature of Dharma and connect with the Buddha mind. By the Buddha's great majestic power, I will now explain how to practice the Bodhisattva path in accordance with the truth of the perfection of wisdom. This is not a task I could accomplish by using my wisdom and eloquence alone." After this, Subhuti said, he said this, he paid his respects to the Buddha and explained his intentions. "By your leave, I will now explain how to practice the Bodhisattva path in accordance with the perfection of wisdom." But what is the Bodhisattva path? What is the perfection of wisdom? "I do not see any phenomena which could be called the Bodhisattva, nor do I see any phenomena which could be called the perfection of wisdom. I see no phenomena which could be called either. This is how Bodhisattvas accord with the perfection of wisdom. Buddha, in this way have I been able to perfect the understanding of Bodhisattvas." The Buddha replied joyfully, saying, "Subhuti, Bodhisattvas are Bodhisattvas only in name. The perfection of wisdom is the perfection of wisdom only in name. The connection between Bodhisattvas and the perfection of wisdom is also only in name. All things inherently neither arise nor cease. For the sake of clarity, we use names. This name is not inside, not outside, and not in between. Inherently, it cannot be attained. For example, I is also a name. The essence of I inherently does not arise nor cease. All conditioned phenomena are like dreams, echoes, shadows, illusions, mirages, and the moon in the water. However, if Bodhisattva's wish to realize the state without birth and death, they must continue to practice the Bodhisattva path and the perfection of wisdom. I'm going to give you six of the most important points. First, the Buddha says that although limitless living beings have been led to nirvana, not a single being has been led to nirvana. Second, in the Diamond Sutra, vow comes first, followed by the surprising practice of perfect wisdom. Because realization of the emptiness of the vow is what protects the Bodhisattva vow. When we know we can't grasp the vow, we will let go of it. Third, things do not come to be of or by themselves, but through the support of everything other than themselves. All phenomena are nothing more or less than the support of everything other than that phenomena. Therefore, the very reason a thing is itself is precisely the reason that it is not itself. So here we have the logic of a mind that has no abode. The words in the sutra that opened Layman Lu's mind into awakening. This is the logic of the non-abiding mind. Fourth, the Heart Sutra makes the shocking statement regarding the Four Noble Truths. It says that given emptiness, there is neither suffering nor the end of suffering, neither the arising of suffering nor the non-arising of suffering. That's the second noble truth. Now the third, neither the cessation of suffering nor no cessation of suffering. And neither the path to such cessation nor no path to such cessation. So, given emptiness, none of the four truths have a basis in reality. Fifth, Zazen is beyond the realm of knowing Zazen or not knowing it or knowing it just a little, nor is it a condition where Zazen deepens. Zazen is Zazen, and that is all there is to it. And finally, sixth, it is impossible not to come to an understanding of the true self if you seek the Dharma and Zen. And I have three ideas for your reflection during the week. And the first one is about the words of Subhuti. When we disciples teach, because you're going to, at some point, someone's going to ask you a question about Zen, and you'll have to answer it. And this is basically telling you how you should think when you answer it. When we disciples teach, no matter how elementary or profound the topic, so long as we are able to adapt to the listener's ability and accord with the Dharma, we must rely on the Buddha's majestic powers. And so what do these words mean to you personally? When someone asks you a question about Zen, what do these words tell you? To really think about that so that you're ready. And secondly, these words of Seike Harada Roshi, Zazen of the body, speech, and thought all take place separately from the consciousness of the ego self. And I want you to think about, what exactly does he mean? What does that mean to you? And thirdly, Shakyamuni Buddha said, each person practicing Zazen, truly forgetting his self and settling into his position, working at eliminating delusion, will surely succeed. And he gave the example, if you hold a stick in your hand and aim for the ground below you, no matter which way you strike the ground, it's impossible to miss it. And in the same way, it is impossible not to come to an understanding of the true self if you seek Dharma and the Zen. And Zen, many students hear this and go, oh yes, but in their hearts, they're really quite certain they'll never attain enlightenment. And so I'd like you to think about what happens for you when you hear these certain words of the Buddha. So you should know what happens to you. The Buddha has said this absolute statement. And then what do you think? What's your personal take on that? That's for your reflection during the week, those three things. And those will be posted. So this was a surprising talk for all of us. Some shocking things are said. And I wonder if there are questions.
So we have a comment, Gail. So the comment that we got is, regarding the Buddha's idea that it is impossible not to come to an understanding of the true self if you seek the Dharma and Zen. I believe that he thought that, and I also believe that saying I'm the one exception is a form of pride. I can't help but feel that my posture isn't all that great, my breathing isn't all that great. I'm thinking the whole time, and that is truth, I sort of do feel I'm the one exception. I don't think I can be convinced of anything different, frankly.
You know, I do. I'm sure you're. I totally believe what you're saying. And I think a lot of us feel like everyone else can attain enlightenment, but not me, kind of. If you, things are happening on multiple levels, and if you take a real careful look at yourself, there probably are changes in you as a result of practicing Zazen. That you can notice and it's maybe not what you're, it's maybe not where you're expecting the changes to be, but for example, just being a softer person, not getting the edge of your anger might not be quite as sharp, and being just more gentle, or just a tiny bit more calm, or patient. These changes on kind of our character, changes on a character level, are the beginning of changes in the whole kind of body-mind complex. And it's the beginning of you coming into a place where you could mature into nirvana. You should pay close attention to these things. You might have noticed them or thought, well, it happened that time, but it's never going to happen again. Pay close attention and maybe even take notes on subtle changes that take place in you now. And I think that's the result of your practice. And you may think, well, that doesn't add up to anything, but you know, we're also saying that there's nothing at the end for it to add up to. I think this is where devotion comes in. We just have to believe the Buddha, that's all. We just have to believe that it's just like striking an arrow onto the ground. You can't miss. You just can't miss. And you're not an exception because there are no exceptions. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Another question that we got is, can you say more about Subhuti's statement, when we disciples teach, no matter how elementary or profound the topic, so long as we're able to adapt to the listener's ability and accord with the Dharma, we must rely upon the Buddha's majestic powers. I don't see how we actually accomplish all this in any one teaching moment.
I can give you an example from when I was teaching in Paramahansa Yogananda's ashram, or one of his practice places, where there was a Sunday school for children, and I taught like 9 and 10 year olds. And most of the class was crafts, making some object that had to do with Master Paramahansa Yogananda or his teachings. And then there was a 10 minute meditation, and they sat in their little chairs, you know, with their straight back. And I talked them through a 10-minute meditation. And I had never done this before, and I had no idea really how to do this. But I kind of knew what was important to them and how they thought. I mean, I knew them just by doing crafts with them. And so just based on that, I just kind of made it up, really. But while I was making it up, I was praying to Master, like just please help me do this. And, you know, the words just came. I mean, I'd never done this before, and I'm not a mother, and I, you know, I don't regularly talk to 9 and 10 year olds, but I just prayed, and out of my mouth came the right thing to say. And then the 10 minutes were over, and they were very happy with themselves. And because they really did a very good job of sitting there and trying to concentrate. They were just adorable, actually. And that's an example. And the part about invoking help from an energy larger than you is very significant. And we have the Buddhas who are rising from the earth at all times. It is said that they're rising from the earth to help the welfare of all beings at all times. And I really hope that they're active in certain parts of the world right now. But we can invoke this energy, and it helps us. So that's how it all can take place at the same time. But I think Subhuti was correct in saying that he couldn't do it without the majestic power of the Buddha, even Subhuti, foremost in wisdom, used that practice. And so we can do that too. And when I say teaching, I'm actually thinking of you in an ordinary situation, having dinner with someone who knows you're interested in Zen and asks you a question, and then you have to drum up something. And this is how to do it. Just invoke the, just say, you know, right now, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, I need you to help me. What should I say? See what happens. Thank you.
So we have 2 minutes, Gail. Should I ask the last question?
Oh, okay.
So the question that we just got is, from my understanding, Dogen taught that we all are enlightened already. And enlightenment is just exactly as we are at this moment. I have tried to realize this, but have a hard time accepting that enlightenment can be so mundane. Sometimes life is just mundane. Is this really the true nature of the universe? The question came with an apology about it being a big question without much time.
That's all right, because I've already answered it. The part in the talk about since conventional truth has no basis in reality, and since ultimate truth has no basis in reality, there's no basis for us to separate ultimate truth and conventional truth. So enlightenment and our regular normal daily experience is the same thing. So when I think it was Subhuti who got to the place where there's no basis for separating nirvana from samsara. Samsara is our conventional ordinary life, and nirvana is the perfection of wisdom. And there's no basis for separating them when you deeply, deeply look. So all I can tell you is that when you deeply, deeply look, there's no basis for separating them. So you haven't looked deeply enough. there's no basis for separating them. So we have to be able, and for me too, I'm talking to myself, we have to be able to find, by fully entering into each and every action that we take, 100% entering into the action, we give over our ego self and enter into that place of no abode. I think this is why Reb named his monastery No Abode, because it's that place where we all want to be holding ourselves in the mind of non-abiding. I'll stop there because I need to thank, not need, I want to thank my team, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, for all of the work they do behind the scenes, and also for you for coming and listening to my talks. I'm so grateful, and I'm grateful to the people who listen at other times as well. So I hope I will see you next week for our last talk in this series. And then I'll tell you more about the next series. Bye-bye.